Thank you for that kind introduction, and hello to everybody in Australia. I'm speaking to you from Canada and from Eastern Ontario. This is where I am, is unceded traditional Algonquin territory of the Anishinaabe people, and I'm speaking with great respect for the Indigenous people who have walked this land for so long. Over a century ago, the great Irish revolutionary James Connolly wrote a poem that I think is very relevant to today's meeting, today's subject. The poem was called Be Moderate. And the opening verse went, "Some men faint-hearted ever seek our program to retouch, and will insist whene'er they speak that we demand too much. 'Tis passing strange, yet I declare such statements give me mirth, for our demands most moderate are. We only want the earth." That's what we want. We only want the earth. We want to wrest our planet from the hands of the vandals who are destroying it. We only want the earth. Nothing less will do. You know, today's student strikers and the Extinction Rebellion protests are big steps in the right direction. Those activists are building an independent radical counterforce in the streets, and eco-socialists fully support them in that absolutely essential effort. Now, it's very different, of course, with the Liberal Greens, whose entire focus is on lobbying our masters to solve the crisis for us, and who are afraid of alienating capitalist politicians and corporate executives. There's another verse in Connolly's poem that describes their approach. "Be moderate, the timorous cry, who dread the tyrant's thunder. You ask too much, and people fly from you aghast in wonder." Typically, environmental liberals insist that the best way to stop climate change, if not the only way to stop it, is to put a price on carbon, usually by imposing some form of tax on fossil fuels. The theory says that emissions will decline if prices are nudged up. They rarely address the fact that although oil prices have risen radically in the past 50 years or so, production and emissions have risen at the same time. Rather than switch to alternative sources of energy when oil got expensive, the oil industry went after unconventional oil, fracking and mining tar sands. Despite that, many sincere Greens believe we can fix the world just by nudging the market a little bit. Unfortunately for such wishful thinking, what humanity now faces is not a single solvable problem that can be dealt with by a minor tax change, but a convergence of ecological crises that actually threatens the survival of civilization. Now, climate change is, of course, the most extreme and immediate aspect of the emergency, but we also face superstorms, rising sea levels, massive wildfires, toxic air and smog, ocean acidification and dead zones, species extinction, soil erosion, freshwater depletion, ozone destruction, indestructible plastics and chemical pollution, deforestation, expanding deserts, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and new diseases and plagues. And the list goes on and on. This is a planetary emergency. What we confront are not individual problems that modest reforms and policy shifts can fix, but a complex and interlocked set of disruptions of the natural processes that have made Earth habitable for thousands of years. 12 years ago, in 2009, a team of 28 internationally renowned scientists convened by the Stockholm Resilience Center identified 9 planetary boundaries that define what they call a safe operating space for humanity. Crossing any one of those thresholds, they wrote, could have deleterious and even catastrophic consequences for human well-being. They updated their report in 2015, and it showed that 7 of the 9 critical planetary boundaries are close to or already in the danger zone. Something has gone terribly wrong with the relationship between human society and the Earth. Addressing the symptoms alone is dangerous. A fix for one problem may make other problems worse. Radical remedies are obviously required, but we won't find a cure unless we identify the underlying cause, the systemic disease that is attacking our life support systems. Many environmentalists identify the underlying problem simply as growth. And in fact, as many books and articles have shown, the drive to extract, produce, and grow ever more stuff is filling our rivers with poison and our air with pollution. Oceans are dying, species are disappearing at unprecedented rates, water is running short, and soil is eroding faster than it can be replaced. But the growth machine pushes on. Corporate executives, economists, bureaucrats, and politicians all agree that growth is good and non-growth is bad. Unending material expansion is a deliberate policy promoted by ideologues of every political stripe, from social democrats to conservatives. And when the G20 met in Toronto, near where I live, a few years ago, they unanimously agreed that their highest priority was, quote, to lay the foundation for a strong, sustainable, and balanced growth. The final declaration they issued was only a handful of pages long, but the word growth appeared 29 times. Uncontrolled growth is clearly a central issue, but that only raises a further question. Why does the growth continue? Why is it, in the face of massive evidence that expanded production and resource extraction is killing us, do governments and corporations keep shoveling coal for the runaway growth train? In most environmental writing, one of 2 explanations is offered. Either it's human nature, or it's a mistake. The human nature argument is central to mainstream economics, which assumes that human beings are always want more, so economic growth is just capitalism's wonderful way of meeting human desires. For our species, enough is never enough. That often leads its proponents to conclude that the only way to slow or reverse the pillaging of Mother Earth is to slow or stop population growth. More people equals more stuff, so fewer people would equal less stuff. That claim, unfortunately, is fatally undermined by the fact that the countries with the highest birth rates have the lowest standard of living. The people in those countries own the least stuff and produce the least pollution. There was a study done at Yale University a few years ago that concluded that if the poorest 3 billion people on the planet somehow disappeared tomorrow, there would be virtually no reduction in ongoing environmental destruction. The other common explanation for the constant promotion of growth is that we have been seduced by a false ideology. The drive for growth has been described as a fetish, an obsession, an addiction, even a spell in one book I read. Such accounts prevent the drive for growth as a choice that politicians and investors make under the influence of a rather bizarre obsession. But as the British Marxist Fawzi Abraham says, this must be the first time in history that a necessity has been described as a fetish. You might as well describe fish as having a fetish for water, as capitalism having a fetish for growth. Growth is as essential to capitalism as water is to fish. And as a fish would die without water, so capitalism would drown without growth. Growth ideology doesn't cause perpetual accumulation, it justifies it. Uncontrolled growth is not the root of the global crisis, it's the inevitable result of the profit system, of capitalism's inherent drive to accumulate ever more capital. As individuals, the people who run the giant polluting corporations undoubtedly want their children and grandchildren to live in a clean, environmentally sustainable world. But as major shareholders and executives and top managers, they act, to use a wonderful phrase that Marx came up with, they act as personifications of capital. Regardless of how they behave at home or with their children, at work they are capital in human form, and the imperatives of capital take precedence over all other needs and values. When it comes to a choice between protecting humanity's future and maximizing profit, they choose profit. And the reason they do that is very simple, although its implications are very complex and profound. Big banks and money funds and multimillionaires invest in order to make more money back. They really don't care if the company they invest in makes cars or clothes or candy bars, so long as they get a return on their investment, as long as they get more out than they put in. Corporations, you see, are giant social machines for turning capital into more capital. That's what shareholders want and expect, and that's what managers and executives must deliver. A person who's unwilling to put the needs of capital first is unlikely to become a major corporate executive. And if the screening process fails, or if a CEO has an inconvenient attack of conscience, he or she will not last long in that position. It has been called the ecological tyranny of the bottom line, when protecting humanity and the planet might reduce profits, corporations always put profits first. Capital has only one measure of success: how much more profit was made in this quarter than in the previous quarter? How much more today than yesterday? It really doesn't matter if the sales include products that spread disease, destroy forests, demolish ecosystems, and treat our water, air, and soil as sewers. If it contributes to the growth of capital, that's what counts. Each corporation seeks to ensure that its products produce an attractive profit on invested capital. A corporation with lower costs or more attractive products can drive its competitors out of business. There's a constant pressure to expand physically, financially, and geographically in order to increase capital and thus to increase profit. If nothing stops it, capital will try to expand forever and infinitely. But of course, the planet is not infinite. The atmosphere and the oceans and the forests are finite, limited resources, and capitalism is pressing against those limits. That is the defining feature of the capitalist system and the root cause of the global environmental crisis. Mass opposition and public pressure can slow down or hinder the drive for more, to expand more and faster, but it will always reassert itself in some form. It's like an autoimmune disease that attacks the body it dwells in. Capitalism is both part of the natural world and at war with it. It simultaneously depends upon and undermines our planet's life support systems. Capital's ecologically destructive impacts are driven not only by its need to grow, but by its need to grow faster. The circuit from investment to profit to reinvestment takes time to complete, and the longer it takes, the less total return the investors receive. Competition for investment produces constant pressure to speed up the cycle, to go from investment to production to sale ever more quickly. That's why in 1925, it took 16 weeks to raise a 2.5-pound chicken. Well, today, chickens twice that big are raised in 6 weeks. Selective breeding, hormones, and chemical feed have enabled factory farms to produce not just more meat, but more meat faster. The suffering of the animals and the quality of the food are secondary concerns, if they're considered at all. Fertile land is destroyed, forests are clear cut, and fish populations collapse, all because of what the brilliant Marxist philosopher István Mészáros called the incurably short-term horizon of the capital system. There's an insuperable conflict between nature's time and capital's time, between the cyclical processes that keep the earth going that have developed over hundreds of millions of years, and capital's need for rapid production, sale, and profit. Since the middle of the 20th century, capitalism has caused unprecedented changes in the entire biosphere, in Earth's lands, forests, water, and air. In its everlasting and endless search for profits, capital is massively destroying and disrupting Earth's life support systems, the natural processes and cycles that make life itself possible. What Marx called metabolic rifts have become metabolic chasms in our time. That's why the environmental crisis can't be just a talking point for socialists, not something we write the odd article about and move on. It's a planetary emergency that we have to treat as a top priority. We have to initiate and join struggles for immediate environmental aims. We need to participate, not as sideline critics, but as activists, builders, and leaders. And at the same time, we need to find the best ways to patiently explain how those struggles relate to the larger fight to save the world from capitalist ecocide. In every country, we need governments that break with the existing order, that are answerable only to working people, farmers, the poor, indigenous communities, and immigrants. In a word, governments that answer to the victims of ecocidal capitalism, not to its beneficiaries and representatives. Such a profound transformation will not just happen. In fact, it will not happen at all unless ecology has a central place in socialist theory, in the socialist program, and in the activity of the socialist movement. In short, in the 21st century, socialists and greens must be eco-socialists, and humanity needs an eco-socialist revolution. As James Connolly wrote, our demands most moderate are, we only want the earth. Thank you.